So, okay, this is a kind of a resurrected talk, actually. My laptop collapsed on Wednesday, 10 minutes after having prepared the talk, so it's in repair now. So what I will be talking about is perhaps in continuation of what Ralph and Chris Feder have been talking, which is what regulates the star formation efficiency in the cloud. So star formation yields a very large number of observables, which you can try to predict. Some of them are in the gas phase, so you can check the core mass function, and you can check both the clump mass function and then the core mass functions for those with Cartesian bound. You can check if your models use the scaling relations between the different quantities of the gas, the velocity, dispersion, size, mass, et cetera. And for protostars, you can check something like the accretion rates from the envelope to the disk, and eventually with Alma now, we're starting to probe the accretion perhaps at smaller scales. Then there is the final product, is the INF. You have the integration of this final product over the entire spectrum of masses, which is the star formation efficiency. But you have also other quantities which are seldom looked at by modelers, which are the edge spread between the stellar population and the cluster. And then you have things like the spatial distribution of stars. You have the dynamics, the velocity distribution of the stars, and also important quantities such as binarity and multiplicity. So I'll be focusing on these two here in this talk. So just a quick, I mean, you all know these numbers, but just to refresh your mind about this. So molecular clouds have a spectrum of masses, maybe with the power law of -1.7, -1.8. And there has been prediction for this exponent from analytical theory by Patrick and Bell for non-gravitationally bound objects. But most of the mass is contained in massive clouds, say, between 10 to the fourth to a few times 10 to the sixth. Their sizes are 10 to the third parsec. The temperature is somewhere between 10 and 30. And they have Mach numbers between 5 and perhaps a little bit larger in some clouds. Their free-fall time is of the order of 1 million years or so, a few million years, and the same is with the crossing time. So now, the way I don't have an easy way of defining what is the star formation efficiency. The star formation efficiency in a non-isolated system is, you can define it as the mass of the cluster divided by the mass of the original reservoir of gas plus whatever is continuously accreted. But you may have clouds that are being dispersed, so it can be a minus sign, for example. And you never know what is the initial reservoir of mass when star formation starts. Now, even using this simplistic formula, and assuming that you are dealing with bound clouds, so the star formation or the final star formation efficiency will be something either bound between unity and some smaller quantity, which is the value at which the gas has been expelled and star formation has ceased. Now, in the observations, it's even much kind of reduced.
Why do you bound it by unity? Why do you bound it by unity?
I'm saying,
Why?
If it's unbound, then you might not have.
Yeah, but why do you bind it by unity?
Because you exhaust all the gas.
Well, if you define this formula, it can be any value, so why?
Assuming a simple system where this will be small, I mean, you will tend to.
No, but why do you put unity here? Unity is completely relevant.
No, assuming that you have an isolated system and for all the gas turns into stars.
Equations or whatever it gives you, that's
the example. In this case, it shouldn't be unity. I'm saying, well, maybe the writing of unity in that context is not correct. But assuming an isolated system, it might go to unity at most. So in the observations, it's even more difficult to estimate because you don't know anything about the initial reservoir of gas. So it's estimated as being the current stellar mass in the cluster divided by the total mass in stars and gas. And when people try to apply this formula to say, embedded or semi-embedded clusters, you tend to find a large range of values between, say, 5 to 60%. And these are typically applied to regions surrounding clusters. So this is a couple of parsecs at most, or a few parsecs. Now, extended to entire clouds, typically this gives you values of 1% or maybe 10%. And not in your paper, you mentioned something up to 20% of that. So in galaxies, the star formation efficiency is defined slightly differently, at least for galaxy integrated, so it's star formation rate divided by the mass reservoir for star formation, if you believe this is the H2, so this is the inverse of that is the depletion time. And here I've plotted, I've compiled a number of data points for different galaxies, and plotted them as a function of the metallicity, the average metallicity of the gas in the galaxy, of the galaxy, so stars. These are older measurements here, so with poor spatial and spectral resolution, and these are newer ones. So there might be still a trend in which the star formation efficiency increases with decreasing metallicity. So I only found these few points here, but I think it would be interesting to update this plot and include more data.
Well,
yeah?
The same survey, right, has hundreds of points there.
Yeah, but they don't have metallicity.
I don't have anybody else, I'm sure everything is known about them.
Probably finding LSC, you have to dig around the edge. They're very well known. Yes.
Yeah.
Also, it's been shown that any trend of low metallicity is probably X factor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll talk about this, so I have perhaps an explanation about this, but I know about this point. So just to put things in context about why, what do we expect for the star formation efficiency in the individual molecular cloud. So the way I wrote here the star formation efficiency compared to the previous one is that it's normalized by the star formation timescale. So this is an absolute value. Yeah? So if you take all the, if you measure all the H2 gas via CO observations, you get the value, in the galaxy, you get the value of 2009. And if you assume that the time step for star formation is the free fall time, then you get very high star formation rate. I mean, this has been pointed out a long time ago. And even if you assume star formation efficiency, which is a 1 or 10%, then you still end up with star formation rates which are too high compared to what is currently observed between, let's say, 0.7 and 1.5. So this is telling us that probably we have molecular clouds have, some people suggested in the past that molecular clouds maybe have lived for several times, the free fall time, and you still need the star formation efficiency to observe the, to get the observed star formation rate. Now, this is a very simplistic picture because molecular clouds start forming stars as they grow in mass, so it's not like you have a reservoir of mass and then this cloud stays idle and then it has to live for this amount of time. So the free fall time or the crossing time of the cloud changes over time. So maybe you need both of these, but at least you need a low star formation efficiency in clouds. And so the question is, what stabilizes the cloud against gravitational collapse? If the clouds live longer than free fall time, then there must be continuous sources of turbulence in the cloud, because we know that supersonic turbulence that is observed in the cloud will decay over one crossing time.
So just to be clear, for big molecular cloud, which is where most of the star formation takes place, mm-hmm. things that are above us to make the solar system. Certainly in other galaxies, you know, classic spiral, you know, galaxies, but even the Milky Way, you know, they can't really live 20.
No, I don't, you know, I'm saying, you may have a bit of both. I mean, they may live for a few times.
Yeah, okay.
Less of a time. I'm just this mathematical argument using the exact values that were there.
Yeah.
But I don't believe this number to be true. So I'm just pointing out that you, even if that is true, you still need this low star formation efficiency.
Doesn't make sense. Match a little bit the numbers.
The numbers don't match, yeah. Three full time is
to get this value, Well, I didn't.
The freefall time is 5 million years. The gas consumption time scale on the galaxy scale is 2 billion years. So the ratio is 2 times 9 divided by 5 times 6. So it's much
it's 400.
It's 400, but
not 2,000. So it's factor of 5. So 20 should be 4.
No, it should be like more 200.
You know, I didn't do the exact numbers for, but the point is that they may live a few times the freefall time.
But that number doesn't imply anything about lifetime of molecular clouds. So.
No, I personally believe that it doesn't imply the, because the lifetime is a bit ill-defined problem. I mean, when do you start considering what is the formation of molecular clouds?
Well, you take your observation,
you see all, but there is a.
They're always near spiral arms, right?
Yeah.
And they're drifting relative to the spiral arm, the degree of velocity which you can at least estimate. And you can see how far away from the spiral arm they are. You can use that as an age.
Right, but we know from simulation that because in the observations we see them in CO, right? From simulations, we know that, for example, colliding flow simulations where molecular clouds start forming. There is a long assembly period of 10, 20 million years where you pile up H2 until you become a thick, and then you start having CO.
Which is when you see them. From then on, you know the length.
Oh, I saw that people looked at the gaps, right, between the spiral, age of spiral arm and molecular gas,
right.
And never found them, right? So the formation time for molecular clouds is very small.
I think that's probably right. The formation time observation is small, and their lifetime is also. Now, what people see in simulations,
well, simulations
is what they see in simulations.
McLaughlin, McLaughlin, right? It's 2 million years.
Right.
For the formation.
Yeah. Which seems reasonable.
Right.
There's a big debate about that. It's
I think some people are getting 20 million, a few tens.
Nick Scoville would probably still say 10 to the 8th year.
So. No, he would, and I've talked to him many times.
Yeah.
It's completely wrong.
And he's arguably incorrect.
Yes.
And actually, if you go well enough, you can get into it.
That's why this.
I'm sure that's
published
true.
Any year.
Yeah.
Okay, so this brings me to part two. So I'll be discussing about the role of. Very briefly about the effect of some of these processes in acting against gravity and trying to regulate the star formation efficiency. So just most of you again know this, but for someone maybe for people who are not familiar, so the role of turbulence has been explored over the last say 20 years using analytical theory and mostly using simulation. So the basic idea of supersonic turbulence regulating star formation is that you get a network of compression in the medium, and in some location the compression becomes so large that the density is so high that the local freefall time becomes much shorter than the global freefall time of the cloud, and then you get local collapses in the cloud without the cloud collapsing as a whole. So people have worked using numerical simulations. I've done some of these with Enrique Vasquez and John Sukim. So one of the main outcomes of supersonic turbulence in cloud is that it gives you a typically more or less a log normal density distribution of the density field. And if you include gravity, then you develop the power law at the high density tail. And this is probably where, you know, star formation will start occurring. Perhaps I think there is still a lot of work that can be done here, because analytical theories of star formation that try to derive the rate and so on don't use this power law rate in the derivations. So, but you know, I'm not sure, as far as I know, that the slope is very precisely established. It might depend on resolution.
So at the conference I talked about, yeah. So you can actually understand that slope. The bottom end break there, they understood at all, which is just these disks.
Yeah.
The other part is you can actually analytically calculate that slope.
So someone has published something?
I have not published. I just talked.
And the same can be observed, and if you have a two-phase medium, again, the high-density gas develops a log normal, and then power law if you include gravity. So these ones are without gravity and these ones are with gravity.
Go back, just what was that again? What was different about that?
So these are two things, I mean, you have a...
Oh, you had...
Don't care too much about the normalization.
The other one's
because
isothermal.
The previous one is isothermal, and this has two-phase medium.
Yeah, what's the difference? No, sorry, the difference between left and right. What is it?
So here there is no self-gravity, and here there is self-gravity.
So when you say right. Two-phase, what do you mean exactly?
So one-phase and a polar phase.
No, but what physics is it?
So you have a simple cooling function, and then you have the gas at 100, with the cup of 100, and then you have gas at 10,000.
So you're heating and cooling the gas.
These ones are the driven. So Ralph Gleason was one of the first ones to measure the star formation efficiency in such turbulent supersonic clouds. And he did this by running a series of simulations in which he changed the driving scale of the turbulence. So how do you inject, with which modes you inject the turbulence in the cloud, and with which intensity, so which Mach number. So if you look at the A1, A2, A3, these are three simulations in which the driving net scale of turbulence is going from half the box size to 1/8 the quarter. And you can see that the star formation efficiency increases with the driving net scale of turbulence. Right? And this is relatively understandable. You make a large amount of gas unstable and compress them with instabilities which are the higher, larger wavelength. And then he changed the Mach number, and then so with an increasing Mach number, you get a decreasing star formation efficiency, and then you can look at A1, B1, and C1, which is somewhere over here. And normally you would intuitively think the opposite, that you increase the intensity of the turbulence, then you get stronger compression and stronger star formation efficiency. But actually it works the other way around, and the interpretation is that stronger shocks can not only compress, but they can also destroy previous condensations that are located in the medium.
What is the unit of heat here?
I think this is crossing times.
This cannot be, because it's well established that the PDF becomes wider with increasing Mach number. The wider PDF means that a larger fraction of gas will be self-cavitating at any given time.
People say it's Gibbs mass.
Are you sure? What's really changing here?
Are you sure it's your Mach number?
You know the PDF scales.
Well, I mean, this is parameterized in the terms of the Gibbs mass.
And this is you can actually understand this analytically.
Sound speed, effective sound speed. So if you're increasing this number, it means you're increasing this number.
So like your Gibbs mass just means it's part of the domain of the collapse. So it's actually understanding. Right, you're still running it out, but it's actually. It's not due to the Mach number.
So you're increasing the effective Gibbs mass. That's increased the Mach number. Okay, so I wanted to show you movies, but this was on the crash computer. So
it's better not to have a movie.
So I will say a few words about the magnetic field. I mean, Chris probably has talked about this and Ralph in detail, and Benoit as well has shown simulations about this. So these are two simulations of such molecular clouds with turbulence and with different randomization. And so this is the master flux ratio here is about 9, and here it's about 3. So you can see that the stronger the magnetic field, the smaller is the core. You don't have same particle in this simulation, so it's the mass fraction of perturbation bound cores divided as a percentage of the cloud mass. So it goes from, so if you normalize this in terms of per unit time, so you get core formation efficiency going from about 5% to 33%. Probably you can get some smaller values and higher values of a few percent up to 50%. I mean, this would not be unrealistic.
Wait, so why is it a factor of 5 difference, right? There's not a factor of 5 difference between those lines.
This is logarithmic, right?
Well, let's say it's not factor of 5, right? What required difference between these numbers?
Well, I mean, you have to measure it between here and here and here and here, right?
Well, but then you integrate over different time.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not exactly the, it's not, you know, because I didn't have the same lifespan for the two runs. But I'm not arguing that this is, you know, what I want you to take away is that this, the order of magnitude, this is a few percent up to a few tens of percent, so it's not.
Could you tell me the ignition of the core you identified in the...
So here our cores are defined as, you know, 150 times, 160 times above the mean density. And this is typically where we start finding, if you run a virial, the entire virial analysis for the population of cores, you tend to find that around 150, 200 times the average density, the core starts to be gravitationally bound. For example, these are cores which are defined at a lower density threshold, and they are typically unbound. So this has been observed, as Benoit showed also, this has been observed by many authors. So this is a simulation by Price and Gray. So this is the mass in stars, and the total mass here is 50 solar masses. So you get here. So this is the full line is a hydro simulation, and then with an increasing magnetic field, it goes down as time goes by. So this is at the time they cut the simulations after, you know, 1.5 FIFO times about 16% and going down to a few percent.
Well, where is it?
Is there diffusion, magnetic diffusion in these treatments?
No.
This is magnetic diffusion. Yeah. And is the field an average field or is it a terminal field?
Well, they start with a well aligned
field
and then
observing. So there's magnetic flux through the domain.
Yeah.
You just showed it was the opposite way, right? And then, what was mu c in the previous plot?
It is going in the right direction. So this is a larger blue and smaller.
What is mu?
The mass to flux ratio, the mass to movement force. Mm-hmm. Which is basically this quantity normalized to critical value for. So the point that I want to make here is that it's only a matter of time before, you know, this, if you don't have a stopping mechanism, it's only a matter of time for the entire cloud to turn into stars. Right? So you must have mechanisms to regulate the star formation efficiency. For example, plateau it or cut it at this value over there. So then comes feedback, and I don't think after the discussion this morning I should run into a definition of feedback and different meaning of feedback, and so you can have different effects, of course. But let me directly go to some of the results. So this is the simulation Nakamura-san pointed out in his discussion session. So this is their simulation. It's a region that is forms a cluster, you know, the same mechanisms of graphical implementation, and then there is these seed particles for which there is a subgrid model to inject jets and outflows. So as he pointed out in the discussion, yes, outflows manage to inject sufficient kinetic energy in the medium such as to maintain the turbulence over many, at least here it's shown over 2, 3, 4 times. But if you notice, most of the gas is not dispersed, at least at the time they ended the simulation, most of the gas is still located more or less in a very centrally condensed shape. So this is a question we discussed. What happens? Do we need to evolve the simulation much longer? Is the magnetic field amplification will be responsible for amplifying the field and such as to prevent further star formation? This is, I think, not in question, perhaps. But unless the alternative is that you form these clusters in very unbound cloud, and then you form stars, and then most of the gas disperses immediately afterwards. The alternative, if you have clusters which can form massive stars, then you can have feedback from the massive stars, so they're in the form of unlimited radiation. So this is the opportunity there. And then, you know, there's a massive star sitting somewhere here, and then Fatman has that, perhaps creates a ring and secondary star formation in that place. And so this was only photoionization. This is another simulation in which there is only winds. So in this simulation, there are four massive stars which form, and he injects momentum from these four massive stars. Now the simulations, and I think it is the case even until now, people were never able to evolve them long enough to reach a state where star formation will completely cease and disperse the entire cloud. So I've tried to look at this in a very simplistic way, using a very simple toy model. And so it works like this. You take a hot cluster pump, so masses between 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 6. You will give it a radial density profile, and you assume that there are different positions in the clump. So this is really, there is no hydro, there is no dynamics. It's a very simple picture. You assume that a gravitational fragmentation takes place, and you have locally a spectrum of a gravitational bound protostellar cores. And you can use an analytical theory for gravitational fragmentation for that purpose. So this shows you an example of how it works. And then here, some of the cores, you know, they have finite lifetimes. So you can give finite lifetime between 1 times and 10 times the flow flow. And then these cores will collapse and start forming stars and populate the IMF and then start giving you feedback, at least for the most massive ones. And so, you know, time goes from top to bottom, and this is the core mass function. You start forming the first generation of cores, and then some of them collapse and populate the IMF. Now, this is perfectly one-to-one mapping here, and this is the simplest case, but in practice, you can add additional physics. You can let these cores accrete over time. So these protostellar cores can accrete over time, and so this can change the core mass function as it evolves. And so you don't necessarily have a one-to-one relationship between the CMF and the island. Well, then you can have, for example, in closely packed environment, you can have a coalescence of the cores, and then you know, have perhaps a flattening of the CMF at the higher mass. So feedback, I consider the feedback from stars more massive than 5 solar masses, and then. In this first exercise, this was only the stellar winds. So what I need to know is the mass loss rates of the stars and the internal velocity, and then simply integrating over the mass spectrum of stars the kinetic energy that they deposit, and assume that only a fraction of this kinetic energy, and then this again a free parameter here, only a fraction of that wind energy will oppose gravity in this environment. So this is simply showing the, so we ran a stellar evolution code for massive stars on the main sequence for different metallicities between one time solar and 2 times solar. We calculated the mass loss rate and most importantly, this quantity m dot the n squared. And you can see that metallicity has an effect. So there is almost a linear dependence of the of this quantity as a function of metallicity for any given stellar mass. So this is just showing the gravitational fragmentation model of Padovan and Marlon, but you can use Hermitian Charpentier for the initial population of cores that form at each location in the clump. And as time goes by, I start counting the energy that the massive stars deposit in the medium, and then this goes across over time until you reach a point where this ratio gets to somewhere close to unity. And at this time, at this epoch here, we assume that the gas is expelled from the cloud, that the gas is no longer bound, and this defines your star formation efficiency. So basically, it grows up to a point, and then depending on the choice of this efficiency parameter, this kappa, of how much is are your winds efficient in opposing gravity, you get, of course, different answers. Now, this is a very deterministic model. I'm planning to do this with the Monte Carlo approach, so you can get, instead of adding this very deterministic, you can get distribution. But then this, for a given value of kappa, this sets your final star formation efficiency and your expulsion time scale. What I'm showing here is that if you change the core formation efficiency per unit time, you don't get a linear relationship between the final star formation efficiency and the core formation efficiency. And that is because the feedback, at least from the winds, is nonlinear with mass, with stellar mass. So if you inject more cores per unit time, you form more massive stars. More massive stars means much more feedback, which means shorter expulsion timescale, which tempers the final star formation efficiency and gives you a sublinear relationship.
So this time that you have, it goes only up to several times 10 to the 5 years. From when do you start counting it?
From the time the first massive stars form. I will show something about the edge spreads, and so we can compare to real clusters how much does the difference in time between this point and, say, this point, does it match clusters?
So you can compare to observations, though, at least in Milky Way, and even in nearby galaxies, mm-hmm. Like people started to use it. I did this 100 years ago, maybe Harvard Park. And it was noticed 20 years ago by Christmas. If you look at the X-ray emission from star forming clusters in the Milky Way, you can infer the pressure of the hydrogen gas. And the pressure is always way smaller than you get by integrating up the luminosity. And in fact, it turns out, as long as there are ionizing stars around, it's always equal to the H2 gas pressure, which is not surprising given their pressure. Yeah. But the pressure you get from calculating when the ionizing plus the stars, you just calculate what the H2 gas pressure yeah. should be, and you're always within a factor of one or two of what it's actually measured mm-hmm. in both the gas and the H2 gas. Yeah. So what that means, though, is that the energy is kept in the volume mm-hmm. where the stars are forming. Is set by the ionizing gas, not by this hot stellar wind. And the interpretation, this easy interpretation, if I'm correct, is that just the hot winds find ways to leak out.
Different a lot, yes. Well, I mean, this model doesn't describe this realistic picture, obviously. Yeah. So you can think of, if you want to simplify your argument, you can think of this feedback as being some amount of energy being deposited in the cloud.
Yeah, well, this gets back to the question of time scale, right?
But I'm not sure, because you are seeing these clusters and measuring the X-ray emission at an advanced time, where most of the guys
are. No, I've done this by looking at clusters, any star cluster that produces 3P emission, mm-hmm. okay, which includes anything between 0 and 4 million years, essentially, that has a massive star. Okay. And you never see high X-ray fluxes from any of these mm-hmm. Which you would see if they were actually confined.
Okay. Well, that's a very good point, but I'll still make the argument that so these are the same model, but with different velocities, and because of the different energy carried by the winds, so you get for the same for everything being equal in the model, but just changing the metallicity, you get at low metallicity, a longer expulsion timescale. And this means that your star formation efficiency can grow to a much larger value. So this is what is shown here. So basically, you get this dependence of having a higher final star formation efficiency as metallicity decreases. Now, I didn't have, there are no such observations on clusters. I mean, that. On cluster scales, in which you would have, say, a large number of clusters of a given diversity for which you can construct or test this relation. But then here I'm comparing to the galaxy data that I showed you before. Of course, don't expect a very quantitative, but at least the trend is there. And so here I made a little simplification. I call it relative star formation efficiency because I have assumed implicitly that the timescale for star formation is independent of metallicity in different clouds. Otherwise, there is a different correction factor, the ratio of the lifetimes that you have to take into account. So concerning the comparison to the observations, so I've measured for some cluster, for a few massive clusters, the star formation efficiency not using the formula, the observation formula I showed you before, but from these are relatively young clusters, but they are now mostly devoid of gas. So I used the dynamical mass as an estimate of the initial gas mass, and which is measured from stars now, and so took the ratio of photometric mass divided by the dynamical mass and called this the star formation efficiency. And for eight spreads, some people have measured, starting to measure eight spread in massive clusters. So this is a nice work by the group in Heidelberg and Hedemann Swan. And they looked at two clusters. So this is Westerlund 1 and NGC 3603. And so they kind of, using Bayesian statistics to fit the CMDs, they try to constrain the age distribution of stars on the CMD. And for Westerlund 1, they obtained, I think this is the first part of this correction, they obtained an age spread of only 0.4 million years. And for NGC 3603, which is a massive starburst cluster, the age spread is even smaller, of the order of 0.1 solar mass, as a mega year. For the ONC,
so is this spread, it's the spread of ages of stars within the cluster or the amplitude?
Yes, yes. This is the distribution of ages. So the cluster is 5 million years, but the distribution of ages is between, say, 4.8 to 5.2.
That's very, very short. Could you remind us, like, Lynn Hildebrand's study of Orion, which I always think is a benchmark for that, is much broader, isn't it?
Yes, yes. So this is the Orion age distribution of stars, taken by from the latest of Dario et al. So I compiled the ages that they have, and Lynn Hildebrand is on that paper as well. So you get, of course, a much more complex distribution. You have a peak here, and if you believe that most of star formation happened here, then the dispersion is, you know, 1 million years. But if you believe that all of this is part of Orion, then it's much larger. And for Orion, it's much complicated because we know that it's contaminated from in the foreground. And I mean, there has been a couple of papers specifically about that by João Alves recently. And these things are not removed. I mean, so if you put these kind of dual constraints from the models versus the observations, so here I've put the age spread versus star formation efficiency, and I've calculated this for a number of clump masses, cloud masses, and with different core formation efficiency period of time. So either they are constant in the clump, so it's really you're forming cores and stars at a constant rate, or they can be accelerated over time by exponential or power law. What you can see is that, so these models here, the yellow one and the red ones, are models in which the star formation rate in the cloud is increasing. And this is the more constant and uniform star formation rate. So you can see that the starburst cluster, which are Westerlund 1 and NGC 3603, match relatively well. I mean, relatively well is a relative statement. But they fall in the region where you have small H spread and relatively high star formation efficiencies, whereas Orion fall into a regime of more quiescent star formation. These two quantities are notoriously difficult to measure, both of them. So I couldn't find many clusters in which I could have both quantities. So there are many measurements of the star formation efficiencies, but the age spreads are very uncertain. So here again, it could be, I think, useful to have more data to put on this class. And what I should mention is that the star formation efficiency decreases with increasing cloud mass. So this is a cloud for any given model. This is a cloud with 5 × 10⁴ solar masses, and in the intermediate case there is a 10⁵ solar mass, and then lower here there is 5 × 10⁵ solar masses. And this is again because of the nonlinear effect of feedback. You need to put much less feedback, much less in stars to disrupt a cloud.
When you make this calculation, do you assume a fixed IMF that you populate immediately?
I'm not assuming a particular IMF here. I'm taking I'm taking scaling relations between the mass of the cloud, mass of the clump, and the size of the clump, and then taking a gravitational fragmentation model, which depends on the power spectrum or the velocity dispersion inside these clouds, and this fixes me the slope here at the high mass end.
Right, but you populate, you do the immediate transformation from the mass function of course
to mass function of stars. In this case, yes. So it's a one-to-one. As I said, it's here in this case, there is no subfragmentation. It's a one-to-one. So one platform and one stash. I mean, here this plot is very simplistic, but as I said, in the model you can tweak and add some accretion on the cores and add some, and you can add eventually sub-fragmentation, and then you can perhaps lose at any given time the one-to-one match.
Right. So my point is that if stars of different mass form on a different time scale, then they may affect your calculation of H squared.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. That's true, and this is why I need to have a Monte Carlo model to improve on this and get the distribution of, you know, for a given cloud, how much scatter you can get in the H-spec, for example, rather than being a deterministic single value for a given assumed efficiency of the winds, for example, or the feedback. But I agree with that. Okay. So, I think I will try to go through this fast. So what I want to show you here is that now knowing the final star formation efficiency and knowing the expulsion time scale, you can work out what is the star formation rate backwards. And so then try to estimate in terms of scaling laws of star formation what this feedback regulated model gives you. It's not exactly a feedback regulated model, it's a feedback interrupted star formation in clouds model. So if you think about there has been a lot of discussion about the Kennicott-Schmidt relations. So if the surface density of H2 gas times star formation efficiency per unit time normalized by the time scale of star formation. So in the model of Mark Kronholm's, which is based on gravity-turbine fragmentation of molecular clouds, so star formation can happen everywhere in the cloud. There is no preferred location for where you can have stars. And the characteristic mass here is the mass of the JMC. And then if you know from, say, PDR model, or if you, at least in their case, from the metrics, they run separately a PDR model for clouds of different density and measure the fraction of H2, then you can include this in the, and derive a star formation. And then they derived in their 2005 paper a star formation efficiency per freefall time, which depends only on the dynamics of the cloud, so the virial parameter and the Mach number.
What is epsilon?
It's an efficiency parameter for the conversion from cores to stars, because there, in principle, you form cores and then you assume that a fraction of that, a third, for example, will end up in stellar mass. Now. And so this is the...
What's the Mach number in that form?
This is Mach number and virial parameter. And so this is the H2 fraction that they assume this function of surface density for different metallicities. So in my case, I kept this part of the equation the same. This part is the same, and I just recalculated from my analytical model what this would be and tried to compare both results. So in this case, you assume that star formation happens preferentially in clustered mode. You know, it doesn't mean that there is no residual star formation in the cloud, but most of the clusters form in cluster mode. You have to assume a certain clump mass function. A reasonable guess is for gravitationally bound clouds is n^-2, and then the characteristic mass becomes the mean mass over that spectrum of clouds. And then, again, the same prescription for the H2 fraction. And then you can rewrite the same equation. So basically, the relevant time scale here is not the freefall time scale, but the expulsion time scale for any given clusters. And then there is a mean value for integrated over different over the spectrum of cloud. And then you have to calculate the star formation efficiency, the mean value at the, at the expulsion time scale. So you can rewrite all this in terms of the freefall time, if you like. And then, so the star formation efficiency per freefall time would be the star formation efficiency integrated over the cloud or the clump mass mass function. So it is this, and this is n^-2. And this you can get from a grid of models for clouds of different metallicity and different masses, you can get what is the star formation efficiency per freefall time, because you know the final value and you know the expulsion time scale. So this is just showing this, what is the characteristic mass as a function of surface density on the free fall time efficiency problem in time. And then when you put these things together, combining, multiplying with the H2 fraction, you get this result here. So these are the Bigel data from the things, and these are the classical Kennicott entire galaxy points. And these are the results from the feedback regulated model image. Yeah. It's showing plots for going from 0.1 to 2 times solar electricity. And this is the, in comparison, this is the result from Krumholz and collaborators from 2009, where this regulation of star formation in clouds occurs only by turbulence, basically. So, you know, there are differences. The slope is not the same, but also there are differences here in the low surface density regime. For example, their curve for solar metallicity doesn't encompass much regions of the things surveyed. It would imply that there are almost no solar metallicity regions among the 11 galaxies that are considered here, whereas here everything is more.
Well, because such a big difference in metallicity, you should compare with SMC data. That would be the biggest difference.
No, I agree. So I think I'm running out of time, so I will just go very quickly now. I'm happy to have your questions also on that. So there is, so I talked about feedback and so on in the simple model, but there is many other things that can regulate the star formation efficiency. And there was this nice simulation by Carson Meidner and Pavel and Ian Bernal, in which they these are hydro simulations of a 10 to the 6 solar mass clouds, in which they changed the rotation of the clouds. So, and they called this shear in their paper. In fact, I'm not sure it is shear exactly because it's solid rotation. They put initially a solid rotation in the cloud, but they called it shear anyway. And they measured what is the evolution of the star formation efficiency. Here, it's the proxy is this the density in the core as a function of time, and so shear or rotation are increasing from bottom to from top to bottom, and what they conclude is that if we have no shear, we will have a very high star formation efficiency, and we have strong shear, we will have a very weak star formation efficiency. So, independent of this simulations and the terminology, we thought we maybe can check this with current observations, and we went to and looked at galactic molecular clouds from the galactic ring survey. And then for each cloud, you measure the shear parameter, which can be defined as some critical value beyond of the surface density above which shearing motion can destroy the cloud. And so this is very similar to the Virial parameter, where you have actually to the Thumri parameter, but instead of having sigma square, you have a sigma, where A is the Oort constant, and which is dependent on the shear. And so if this quantity is larger than 1, then your cloud is susceptible of being destroyed by shear and otherwise. And so this applied to H1 gas, this seems to work quite well. If you look at some of these couple of galaxies, the values at which the shear parameter approaches unity is of the order of the extent of the optical radius. So it does make a reasonable prediction of where clouds can be sheared. But it doesn't tell you quantitatively whether there is a correlation between the star formation efficiency and shear once a cloud is there. So we use this data from the galactic ring survey, which covers a quadrant of the galaxy. So these are individual clouds identified by a friend-to-friend algorithm. And this is just the surface density of these clouds. And for each of these clouds, we measured the R constant and so on. I'll skip some of these details. So we measured the distribution of shear parameters. So and then you get a relatively narrow distribution. And of course, the values are very small compared to unity. So it would imply that shear is only a small component in the energetics of the cloud. The interesting bit is to try to find a correlation between the shear parameter for the individual galactic molecular clouds and the star formation efficiency. And the star formation efficiency here is the proxy is the infrared bolometric luminosity divided by the cloud mass. Now, of course, there is a caveat here that you are implicitly assuming that the IMF is universal because there is a very high sensitivity. I mean, the survey of this infrared survey is only sensitive to clouds infrared emission above 10 to the 4 solar luminosities. And so you're really assuming that the IMF is universal. Otherwise, if you have a very strong stochastic effect, this might not necessarily be a very good proxy of the star formation efficiency. So if shear was important, we should observe some trend in which S increases, the star formation efficiency decreases, but we don't observe such trend. And we also looked at the correlation between the shear parameter and not the star formation efficiency, but let's say the core formation efficiency, which is here simply defined as being the mass contained into the densest cores in these clouds divided by the cloud mass. And again, we don't find, we cannot see a clear correlation between shear and core formation efficiency. So here are my conclusions, and I just go everywhere. So the star formation efficiency appears to be, I haven't demonstrated that, I just reported observation, something between 1 to 10% in GMC, perhaps can go to larger values in individual protocluster forming clumps, up to maybe 6 to 7%. And among the processes I consider, it seems that magnetic field, turbulence, stellar feedback can indeed affect the star formation efficiency. All of these are internal processes to the clouds, and shear seems to be playing a much lesser role. So I wanted to bring this issue just very briefly. So it's just going to be a couple of slides, but many of these studies we do on star forming regions rely on the fact many times that we either by using it as an ingredient or as an anticipated result that the IMF is universal. And from my reading in the literature, from the observational literature of star cluster, is that observers liked their IMF to resemble the one of the universal ones for the field of the galaxy, but it's not very clear. I mean, so here I compiled the IMFs of in a bin form of 8 galactic young clusters, and overplotted to them is the Krupa IMF, the Chabrier IMF, and the Paravano, Maquis, and Hollenbach IMF with their fiducial field values. Now, you can think of whether any of them fits well or not using the bin data, but actually there is a much better way of looking at this using Bayesian statistics, and that is you don't need to bin at all the data. You just assume prior information over the parameter of the IMF. You assume a likelihood function, and just you calculate the posterior probability of a given set of a given model given the data, and this is what you get. For at least I'm showing it here for one of the likelihood functions, which is the Tapper-Paulov function. So this is Paravano, Maquis, and Hollenbach from 2011, used before also by Gildo-Domanki. So you have 3 parameters: you have the characteristic mass, and then you have the slope at the low mass end and the slope at the high mass end. And so these are the 1D posterior probability distributions, and these are the 2D density distributions. What you can see is that at the 1 sigma limit, there is no overlap, or very minimal overlap between a few clusters. But overall, so the ONC is this one here. So overall, there is a very weak overlap among those clusters. It might mean, I'm not making very, I don't want to make an extreme argument that the IMF is non-universal. These clusters are living in different environments, so they have lost, they are of different masses, so they may have lost some of their stars, and their present-day mass function doesn't reflect their IMF. They have perhaps a different star formation history, so actually it's not age-weighted, so it's all ages are entering in the IMF. And some of them are so young that they might be still forming stars. So this may also affect. But to first order, if you look at it using this a statistical diagnostic, it doesn't seem to the one sigma limit, which is actually what many people do. They fit and then compare the parameter within the one sigma. It doesn't seem to be that universal.
Which is the parameter that is most disparate of those three parameter fits there, which is the...
Okay. Yeah, I mean...
Are they all the same? And
no, I mean, see, for example, it seems that Taurus and NGC 6611 fall always on the same. So this is Taurus and NGC 6611. It's a slightly more massive counterpart of Taurus. They seem to have the same high mass slope and the same, this is here and here, the same low mass slope and the same characteristic mass, which is higher than for the other clusters.
There was this annual review by Bastian et al., who also looked at all the same regions and concluded that IMF is universal. So what's different here?
No. I must disagree. They didn't look in detail at resolved stellar population. I mean, most of them have IMFs
in different clusters. They have a plot of different IMFs.
Yes, but I mean, there is no, it's just plotted, you know? It's just plotted and
these measurements have all kinds of uncertainties. I think they deemed that.
So I've repeated, I didn't show it here. But the uncertainties over the individual masses are never included in the fits. Usually what people do is that they take a bin size, which is of the order of the photometric, for example, uncertainty, but it's not included. So in this paper, I show it, at least for the UNC, the effect of completeness, and because we have the data for the UNC, the effect of completeness and mass uncertainties. And you can change with mass uncertainties, you can change the high mass slope.
Also at different mass ranges, and they are scattered pretty much in the same areas for different clusters. I mean, they're scattered, but you can see a well-defined trend. So, I don't understand what's different between what you do and what they did.
Well, the error there is just an error from fitting the bin data. It's not a...
Yeah, but they get a very consistent result, not all over the place. Like here, for example. Here you have slopes from like 0.5 to 2.5, right?
And I mean, I don't have it here, but if you plot, so this is what it's telling you is that all of these parameter combinations, of course, they come in triplets, are all of them likely. And so if you go and plot this over the bin data, you would see that they all match. And so I would tend to believe that this is a more meaningful result than saying, I minimize the chi-square, because your chi-square minimization has been dependent. And it is shown, I mean, it has been shown previously that your chi-square minimization has been dependent.
What would happen if you use the Chevrier models?
It's the same. It's the same. So in the paper, I have tested this one, the Chevrier and the Cooper. And I've allowed the Chevrier and the Cooper also the border point, I mean, where the slope changes from, say, log normal to power log, to be also a parameter, because I mean, there is no fundamental reason why it should be kept at one. Right? So you see variations also in, so for the Chevrier, you have four parameters, which are the group I have five.
So how do you do this heat? The Bayesian likelihood that you don't bring the data?
Yeah, I there is no fit at all.
To determine the parameters of the MLP.
You mean a single value parameter?
Right.
No, I don't determine a single value parameter. I mean, I can calculate the mean, but the mean is not necessarily the most likely. I can calculate the mean, I can calculate the median, but it's not necessarily, if they are very Gaussian perhaps, but I mean, some of the distribution is.
Well, we just look by eye, right?
So you can just look
by
eye.
They're all consistent with each other.
With?
They're all consistent with each other.
At the one sigma element, they are not.
On one sigma, there is no inconsistency at one sigma. And at one sigma, you can
no, but I'm making the point that people argue about the universality or not in the bin form derivations of this of the parameter, and they compare them to the one sigma.
I'm arguing that
this one sigma that comes out of the binning is biased by the binning.
If you calculate the overlap probability of overlaps for the over significant, if that was the probability of you being killed, then even you cross the street, you would never cross the street.
Yes, I mean, okay. All
those are actually consistent, just saying that the error bars are so wide, you cannot really say anything about the slope, for example.
Yes, but I mean, so. So the point, okay, if you want maybe to think, for example, they are consistent, but I mean, they are not necessarily consistent with, I mean, they are consistent then with a wide variety of values. They are not consistent necessarily with this value.
The errors are large, that's all, right? So, yeah. So when you hit it, we get large errors in the slope. So the slope sounds very well determined.
I don't exactly understand how you want to try to. So you say, for example, do a test.
If you go back to the actual beam cluster, right? Many clusters have very sporadic, sparse. You know, it's sparse. And if you have like for this Parawano Makini model, you have many parameters. And so you have such.
Yeah, three parameters.
Gamma.
The two gammas and the characteristic mass. The two slopes and the characteristic
mass.
So
it's
the two slopes
at
the high mass.
AP as well. AP is
the problem.
SB is
the
normalization,
yes.
No, but that's also fitted, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So you fit four parameters, and if you look at some of these IMF or some of the clusters, it's very crappy, like very sparsely sampled. And so, you know, when you try to fit four parameters, you have lots of degeneracies and big uncertainties.
But this is true for, I mean,
that form is too complicated for these individual IMFs, I mean, which is partially sampled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. For example, for this cluster, the slopes that you derive, for example, at the high mass end is not believable because you don't have data.
Let's take Chabrier, for example, the middle point, right? Mm-hmm. It's very clear that it's consistent with all of them, right? Mm-hmm. All of them are consistent with all, it's just that like in those left ones you have larger errors because it's very partly sampled.
If you want to show that they're not universal, you can do things like KS test on them, right? For example, instead of doing this multi-parameter fits that will never show you the difference because the error bars are so large. Why just don't you do KS test on them?
You have to like show that a given distribution is not consistent with Chabrier rather than try to measure parameters and then show the scatter.
No, but all those fits have proper parameters and so with this.
Well, Chabrier doesn't have four parameters. It has
five. It has the width, the peak, the slope at the high mass and the inflection point and the normalization. So if you have the
normalization, the high mass end, you are not even sensitive here. So your highest masses are like two solar masses. So
these are higher mass clusters.
Right, right. But for like if you try to fit all five, like for those clusters, you have no constraint whatsoever on the high mass end.
I mean, okay,
we
can talk about it. My own personal interpretation is that, of course, you can if. Where I agree with you is that if I would take the because we don't have observers don't publish the uncertainties and the completeness. I would take the completeness and I show it in the paper. If I take a completeness correction for this cluster, these things overlap much. So that's one thing. If I take I can always make up uncertainties on the mass from Gaussians and so on. But and then again, you can make these things overlap very nicely if you account for the uncertainties on the mass and completeness mass limits. But if you take, you know, you assume you have zero uncertainties, I can do the KS test, but to my eyes, these things don't overlap.
There's a better way to do
one sigma.
To the one sigma, yes, because...
I mean, that's ridiculous, right? So you never compare one sigma. I mean, come on.
Because that's what observers do. I'm not
saying... I don't know what observers do.
I agree. If I can take it at the three sigma control, then they would overlap.
That's what I'm saying.
Better. Yeah. Although, we can say that this is the region of overlap and it's around it.
Look at the distributions, right? There's a probability of any two of them intersecting is not small.
I agree with you.
I'm not sure we're
going to
resolve this.
Okay, I'll just show a final slide, which is we are organizing, some of you are interested, we are organizing a workshop on star clusters in Copenhagen in November, so we will discuss. At least on one of the days, we have a discussion of feedback about star formation. But also, the idea of this workshop is to bring also star formation and stellar dynamics together, which is not often the case in conferences. So, if you are interested, you can just visit the website and talk to me.
Well, question: how is the weather going to be in November?
I haven't been in November. I started there two months ago. So, but, I cannot guarantee.
Excellent weather for talking about stellar clusters.
Hmm? Yes, traffic.
So there is one complicated way to test if inertial IMF is consistent or inconsistent, which is better than KS test, which is not very sensitive. What you can do is you can stack all your clusters together, and you fit one global IMF, universal IMF, and you can choose any functional form you want, and you have many more stars, so you can determine the parameters, all the parameters, four or five, pretty well. And then you take this fixed form, and you compare it with individual distribution in each cluster, where you only vary normalization for the number of stars, but not vary any other parameters. And then based on Poisson statistics or any other errors you have, you can compare how consistent each individual IMF of your cluster is with the global. And if you find within the errors they're consistent, then you say, well, yes, they're consistent. But if they're not, then it's a quantitative way to show the deviations. So you determine your IMF the best you can by stacking, and then you do, you don't feed the individual clusters, you just compare.
But the question in this case is, you know, because you are dealing with eight clusters only, you don't know the frequency of these clusters in the galaxy. How representative are they, each one of them, of galactic clusters? So, you know, if you have three of those which have similar parameters versus one of the other ones, so you may be giving more weight to one versus the other, right? I mean, there are some once you do your, So, I mean, I agree with you that this is an important test, but in my mind, you need to have, say 1,000 clusters, which samples statistically significant fraction of different types of population of clusters that may exist. Because otherwise,
all the data you have, then that's all you can do.
Well, I'm hoping for GWST to increase the number.